So we are at war with Iran. And we've been at war with Iran for a long time. We've been watching the Iran war since, well, it's been 50 years. I've been following the story since I was in the sixth grade in 1979. Unlike the other kids in my sixth grade class, I was keenly aware of the situation in Iran because my father, having recently stepped down from the small church where my family attended, he stepped down from pastoring Swan Lake Evangelical Free Church. There was a series of pastors who came in after him, yet we continued to attend the church. And in 1979, the name of the new pastor was Ed Yeager. He had spent a decade or so as a missionary to Iran, where he was also a university professor. I can't remember what he was a university professor, what he was professing as a university professor, but the point is that he had left Iran and now had come to this small town of Cottonwood, Minnesota, where he was filling the pulpit of Swan Lake Evangelical Free Church with stories about his time in Iran. And so we were learning about Persian culture and Iranian Christians. And he brought a geopolitical awareness that was utterly otherwise foreign to this small town of 800 people. I can't remember if he had left the country before the revolution formally began or just after the revolution formally began, but it was around the same time that the Shah of Iran had left the country. And I think a lot of missionaries at that time took the clue that it was time to get out of Dodge. I also remember Pastor Yeager leading us in a Bible study at some point or another in the book of Revelation. And he prefaced it by telling us, you know, that once he had had the privilege of hearing a Messianic Jew, or perhaps he said Jewish Christian, I don't remember, teach the book of Revelation. I don't know who it was, but it was someone he had encountered, I believe, in Israel while visiting Israel. He had said that it was someone who was raised as an Orthodox Jew and later in life became a disciple of Yeshua, a Christian. And what Pastor Yeager said was that he had never before heard such an in-depth and insightful teaching on the book of Revelation. And he spoke about how the Jewish background of the book brought it all together and made sense of the whole thing. But he was unable to reproduce those teachings himself for us. They were beyond him. Well, in any case, that always stayed with me. That really struck me as, you know, here is this most educated man, the most educated man I knew at the time, a brilliant man, really, who I really looked up to, who had been himself amazed and overmatched by the teachings of a Messianic Jew teaching on the book of Revelation in the land of Israel. I don't know why, but Pastor Yeager seemed to take some special interest in me. There weren't a lot to choose from. There weren't a lot of kids in the Sunday school class. There was only three of us in my Sunday school class. But he was the first person to really open my eyes to the existence of the land of Israel, that it exists, that Jews live there, that it's a real place, that it's not just a place in the Bible. And of course, you know, my father as well was a Zionist since 1947. And Pastor Yeager brought us over to his basement of the parsonage there in Cottonwood, and he showed us slides from his trips to Israel. Polaroid slides of the Kotel, the Temple Mount, Zion Gate, Nazareth, Holy Sepulchre, Garden Tomb, Capernaum, and so forth. And this is 1979 I'm talking about. Israel had only been a state for 30 years. So Pastor Yeager, I think, is... I didn't really ever think about it before, but he was a big influence on me. I mean, there he was, you know, he's passing me books that were way beyond my sixth grade reading level, like the weird works of Charles Williams and theological works of C.S. Lewis. But I had so much respect for this man. He was passing me these books. And we were talking about Tolkien, and I was talking about Tolkien with him, and we were talking about Lewis, and he's introducing me to Williams. But, you know, there I am. I'm in the sixth grade, and what I really loved the most was Star Wars. So I gave him a copy of my dog-eared paperback copy of Star Wars to read. I was disappointed when he returned it to me just a few days later, saying he didn't make it past the first chapter. He explained that in the first chapter, there were robots talking to each other, and that was more than he could accept. He assured me that machines would never be able to communicate independently like that. So he was absolutely wrong about that. And I'm sure he was wrong about a lot of things, but thanks to Pastor Yeager, I learned that there was such a place called Iran. And I happened to be paying close attention then to Iran as the Iranian Revolution went into full swing that year. That was my sixth grade year, and for our big class project, we all had to do an independent unit study, as it were, on a specific topic in history or current events, a specific country, something like this. I chose to do a study and presentation on Iranian culture with a focus on the Iranian Revolution, which was happening. It was current events at the time. So for Persian culture, I quizzed Pastor Yeager, and the main thing I remember is some Easter egg traditions, which involve competitions with hard-boiled eggs. But of course, there was quite a bit more to it than that. In any case, we talked about Esther and Mordecai and the Purim story and the Persian Empire. I don't remember all the details, but now I understand the significance. And I remember the revolution. And that's where I focused my attention. I collected all the resources that our little town library had on the subject, which amounted pretty much just to Time magazine articles and a few other periodicals. And I interviewed Pastor Yeager for insights into the student uprisings that had driven him from the country. Who was the Shah of Iran? How did he lose power? Who were these student protesters? Who was the Ayatollah Khomeini? What was a Molotov cocktail? How did college students overturn what was essentially a wealthy, secular, first world country? This was all before the hostage crisis took place. So when the Iranian Revolution was underway and the staff of the American Embassy in Tehran was taken hostage by the student protesters, and the protesters flooded the streets beating drums and burning effigies of President Carter in the streets, I was paying attention. And I remember Pastor Yeager solemnly addressing our little church and urging us to pray for Iran, and people coming to him and asking what he thought was going to happen, and he was counseling us to pray for the hostages and pray for their release. But later that night, in a more private and confidential conversation that he had with my father, which I overheard, I heard him telling my father what he did not want to admit to the church, namely that he had very little hope for the release or survival of those 60-some hostages in the hands of the Muslim fundamentalist students. And he was wrong about that. First of all, the CIA managed to get several of them out of the country by an amazing ruse. What did they do? Using the wild popularity of Star Wars, they pretended they were a Canadian movie production crew that was shooting a science fiction movie like Star Wars, only they were shooting it in Iran. Why not? So disguised as Canadian movie makers and disguised as space aliens or men in space alien costumes, I don't know, they managed to smuggle six of our diplomats out of the country. Of course, we didn't know any of this at the time, But now it's a pretty famous story, and you can see a good Hollywood telling of that famous story in the movie Argo. Not Fargo, but Argo. Fargo is a totally different movie. The movie Argo, and that's how Star Wars saved the first six of the American hostages being held in Iran in 1979. President Carter also tried a Star Wars-style rescue with special forces helicopters that unfortunately were downed in a sandstorm as they attempted to sweep towards Iran, further adding to the sense of national humiliation and anxiety that the whole country was feeling over the fate of the remaining 50 hostages from the American embassy. We were watching on the nightly news every night. ABC News did a television special called The Iran Crisis, America Held Hostage, and the whole country was watching this every night. And the situation went on like this for night after night, and they'd say, day 150, day 151 of the Iran crisis. It went on like this for 444 days. I was sort of feeling that again and living through that again as we were dealing with the hostages in Gaza taken in the October 7th massacre. Well, eventually they changed the name of that nightly update, by the way, from the Iran crisis to ABC Nightline, which of course remained a feature news program for years thereafter and actually created that genre of television. But as a nation, if you remember living through that, if you're my age or older and you remember living through that, we were humiliated and shocked into the harsh realities of Middle East and Muslim fundamentalism. It was like a new shadow that had emerged on the world, a new kind of violent and radicalized Islam that seemed more like something from the era of the Crusades or the Middle Ages. And this came in the wake of the energy crisis of the 1970s and our dealings with OPEC. And suddenly it became clear that our fate was tied to whatever was happening over there in the Middle East. And these new Muslims, these fundamentalists, this was like a new thing for us, a new experience for us. And it's, of course, since then, it's spread like a cancer across the world. But Iran, what happened in Iran, that was the head of the dragon. The revolution in Iran laid the path that others have followed. The Muslim world saw that you could overthrow these Western overlords with their Western values and replace them with clerics and mullahs. So we watched this show for 444 days. And as you know, it continued to the last day of President Carter's administration. What you might not know is that the incoming Reagan administration had orchestrated the release of the hostages, ensuring that it would take place only when Reagan took office. So there was some behind the scenes wheeling and dealing there. But I'm getting ahead of the story. The story I'm telling here, in February of that year, long before the hostage crisis started, just days after the religious fundamentalists ousted the Shah of Iran and overturned the government and established their regime, a Syrian jet flying out of Beirut Airport or Damascus Airport arrived in Tehran unannounced, without a flight plan, without permission, and the Iranians almost shot it from the sky. They sent an intercept to shoot it from the sky. Unfortunately, they did not shoot it from the sky. On board that flight was Yasser Arafat, the leader of the Palestinian Liberation Organization, a KGB-sponsored resistance movement, himself a KGB agent, as it were, doing the Kremlin's bidding in the Middle East. He arrived with a delegation of his Fatah fanatics and PLO so-called independents. This occurred in February 1979, less than a week after Khomeini took power. Prior to that, Arafat had been unwelcome in Iran under the Shah because the Shah maintained close ties with Israel and worked closely with the Israelis, on the down low. But nevertheless, there was a good relationship there. But with the arrival of Arafat, the Israeli embassy was overrun and handed over to the PLO. Khomeini promised to support Arafat and to back up the Palestinian liberation movement and the fight for Israel and to purge the fight for Palestine, I should say, and the fight to purge the land of the Jews. So this marriage made in hell bridged the Sunni-Shia divide in the Muslim world for the common goal of eradicating Israel. In that meeting was born a half century of international terrorism, the type of terrorism that has since harassed Israel, stoked anti-Semitism, and fueled a global anti-Zionist campaign. Within Iran, it became clear that Jews were no longer welcome within the country. So before the revolution under the Shah, maybe you don't realize this, Iran's Jewish community was pretty large. It was some 120,000. That's what the estimate is, 120,000 Jews, mostly concentrated mainly in Tehran. And this was one of the oldest, if not the oldest, continuous Jewish community in the world, dating back over 2,700 years, dating back to, you know, families who could trace their roots back to the Babylonian exile and very likely the Assyrian exile of the 10 tribes. Persian Jews like Esther and Mordecai from the Purim story, this was their community, there in Shushan. One of the oldest Jewish communities in the world. But now the time had come for the Exodus, and Hashem whistled for them to come home. And after 2,700 years in the diaspora, all of a sudden the diaspora vomited them out. And within a year, half the Jews in Iran had already fled, either to America or to Israel. The rest soon followed them, fleeing from religious persecution. That's how it all started. How it all started 50 years ago. And I probably don't need to tell you what's happened since then, because it's all part of the same story. But, you know, for my part, it's an interesting thing. I've not taken my eyes off Iran since that year in the sixth grade, when the whole world was turning on the hinge of this previously obscure little country in the Middle East. Well, it's not such a little country, it's a quite large country in the Middle East. But here in the United States, before 1979, whoever heard of Iran? Since then, Iran has been the major sponsor of war against Israel, propping up the Syrian regime of Assad, operating a proxy military more or less in control of Lebanon, that's called Hezbollah, funding and arming the Palestinians. The Iranian regime is also the sponsor of the Houthis in Yemen. When we first saw this regime, back in 1979, though, these were all college students who looked like college students from anywhere. But they have proven themselves since then to be among the world's most cruel tyrants, exercising their cruelty primarily upon their own population. How much more so wherever else they can in the world. And all of it in the name of service to God. It's probably important to understand a little about the particular type of messianic Islam that is driving the agenda of the fundamentalists within Iran. The type of Islam espoused by the regime is messianic in that they truly do believe in a coming Muslim Messiah called the Mahdi. And in their particular eschatology, they believe that the Mahdi, not unlike Yeshua, ascended to heaven in the past and is only waiting to return and to wage the war of Gog and Magog, to win the war of Gog and Magog, and bring the Messianic era, the global caliphate under Sharia law. But in order to bring the Mahdi, what needs to happen is Iran needs to begin the war of Gog and Magog. They need to start the war against the infidels, particularly the Jews, particularly the great Satan, America, and the little Satan, Israel. They need to start this war, and the Mahdi will come and finish the war. So they're sponsors. They are the sponsors of the October 7 attack. And they have committed themselves to developing nuclear weapons to use against Israel and against the United States. And they've poured their economy into the development of missiles. And that's what makes them so dangerous. This religious belief that through their efforts, they will bring the Mahdi, the Muslim Messiah. And all they need to do is start World War III. And that's why nuclear deals don't work and cash incentives won't work. And neither does threatening them with death and destruction. It does not frighten them because they are a martyrdom religion that prizes dying as a martyr as the highest goal in life. So killing them is doing them a favor. So they're not going to be bullied by threats or bombs. Last summer, Israel and the United States CIA agreed on intelligence that the regime was within weeks or months of completing a nuclear device. And that was when Israel launched Operation Roaring Lion. And the president of the United States also sent our bombers to hit the Fordo nuclear facility in Iran. And since then, the regime has gone into high gear developing stockpiles of missiles. And they also set out to restart their nuclear program and have retained enriched uranium. But it's important to note that the fundamentalists in the regime do not represent the whole population. 50 years ago, Iran was a mostly secular, westernized country. Every so often, those people attempt to rise up and ask for reform, but they're quickly beaten down by the fanatical Iranian Republican Guard. So, for example, last December, this happened again. That's when we saw protesters flooding the streets of Tehran. That's when our president publicly threatened the regime, obligating himself, threatened the regime, encouraged the protesters to take to the streets, and threatened the regime not to harm them, not to use any violence against them, to put down the protests. So this was a red line that he drew in the sand. And the regime responded by cutting off the internet. That is, they blacked out all media and communication going in and out of the country. And then they opened fire on the crowds, even bringing in Arab mercenaries and snipers, massacring their own population, more than 30,000 people, mostly young people, mostly college students, mostly young people the age of those original revolutionaries 50 years ago. And this massacre is what ultimately obligated the United States to respond. And that brings us up to where we are today. Anecdotally, we see that Western Iranians generally are very pro-Israel. And Iranians protesting the regime, very pro-Israel. Yeah, so you will see wherever in the United States or in Canada or in Europe, wherever you have Iranians, the Iranian diaspora coming out in support of overthrowing the regime, in support of the protesters in Iran, you'll see these protest movements, they're waving Iranian flags, not the regime flags, but the old Iranian flags, but they'll also be waving Israeli flags. It's an amazing thing. It's an amazing thing to see. And we also know that there has been explosive growth of Yeshua faith inside of Iran over the last couple decades, which is all the more amazing since it is illegal and persecuted. It's illegal for a Muslim to become a believer, to become a follower of Yeshua. So this forces it to be an underground church movement, so to speak. But, you know, anecdotally speaking, it's fueled by personal visitations of Yeshua in dreams and visions, revealing himself to Iranian people. It's a beautiful thing. He appears to someone in a dream, says, "I am Yeshua." I don't know how often this happens, but it seems like, you know, when you hear these stories, it seems like it's happening a lot. It seems like it's happening all over the Muslim world, but it seems like it's happening a lot inside of Iran. And so there's been this amazing growth within Iran of these believers, new believers, people coming to faith, confessing Yeshua. And if they're found out, they pay the high price of martyrdom for that confession of faith. And this is one of the reasons I've been proud to support ministries like Frontier Alliance International and the spinoff ministry, the Emmaus Table, because they're actually in touch with those underground Christians and supporting local efforts and working among the Kurdish population and so forth. Their workers are on the ground living quiet lives in local communities, blending into the population as foreigners with normal jobs, but, you know, just making contact. And this is how the work gets done in places where the work is illegal. With this current war that we find ourselves in, for which Israel has been suffering, and our Israeli staff members of First Fruits of Zion have spent more time inside the bomb shelter than outside of the bomb shelter in the weeks leading up to Passover, this current war started, you may remember, on Purim. No coincidence there, I'm sure. Purim. What is Purim? Purim is the story of Esther. That's the festival of the story of Esther, which takes place in Iran. That's the story of Esther and Mordecai. So it's on Purim that the war started. It's amazing. 1 month later, as we come to Passover, we came to Passover, things escalated to a breaking point just on time for Passover. President Trump had issued this ultimatum and deadline threatening major catastrophic bombing of civilian infrastructure if Iran didn't surrender. And this deadline was set for then, several days later, it was set for 8 p.m., on the seventh day of Passover. So the initial confrontation was coming into the first day of Passover when the ultimatum was issued, and the ultimatum was set for the seventh day of Passover, the anniversary of the crossing of the Red Sea. So you see how the appointed times seem to be lining up so precisely with what has been happening in the war. So the deadline was set, and what happened? Iran did not budge. They promised to retaliate by bombing their neighbors and essentially lighting up the Middle East and devastating international oil supplies and energy supplies. So a tense situation was gearing up for this climactic battle as we came into the seventh day of Passover and like looking towards this crossing of the Red Sea moment. But it's also a moment, a dangerous moment at which you could see the world starting to slip irreversibly toward World War III, if we have not done so already. And in that moment of brinkmanship, we blinked and declared a ceasefire for negotiations. Now, as I record this audio, that ceasefire for negotiations and negotiations have broken down. We don't know where things go from now. There's talk of an embargo on the, so we're going to put an embargo on the embargo through the Strait of Hormuz. Not sure how all of this works out, but that's where we're at. Nevertheless, the coincidence of the Yom Tov dates reminds us that ultimately Hashem's in control here. And this is his story, not our story. And these things, like all things and all outcomes, are in his hands. There was even that story within the story of the pilot who went down on Good Friday, hid out on Shabbat, and was rescued very early on the first day of the week, a miracle that the United States Secretary of War, Hegseth, compared to the death, burial, and resurrection of Jesus. Strange times indeed. Let's hope and pray that there is a path to peace, that Iran can be rebuilt under a new regime less addicted to terrorism, death cults, and genocide. We should pray for peace in the Middle East, peace in Israel, the peace of Jerusalem. And we should be praying for the revelation of Yeshua to continue in Iran. Because in reality, if the war goes on or continues, the only way to bring it to a satisfactory conclusion would be through a massive ground war, and that is something for which the American people no longer have the political will or stomach, so that does not seem like an option. Much, much better plan for our master to overthrow the regime from within by changing hearts. Ultimately, even if the war were to end today, and not another thing would change, from a purely political perspective, I would see it as a win for the United States and a win for Israel, in that it has neutralized the Iranian threat, defanged the serpent, so to speak, crippled their regional and international influence, and dismantled the infrastructure by which they can manufacture missiles and a nuclear device. But we'll see. The story isn't over yet. It's set up for a sequel. So we should continue to do our part by praying for the government of the United States, praying for the government of Israel, praying for the military of the United States, praying for the IDF, praying for an end to this craziness, this madness. We live in such a time of confusion where truth is thrown to the ground. I truly believe that in this hour, the only way up and to the light is through the revelation of Yeshua of Nazareth. Therefore, the best things we can do is continue to learn his words, to put them on our hearts, to teach them diligently to our children, to write them on the doors of our houses and upon our gates. These are the words of the way, the truth, and the life. And that brings me all the way back around to Pastor Yeager, who I can credit with taking, you know, inspiring me as a young boy, inspiring me with books by Charles Williams and introducing me to the geopolitics of the Middle East and helping me get an A on that unit study that I did on Iran and the Iranian Revolution. There's probably a lesson there which says something about investing in the children and the youth and the young people and the kids around you, the kids under your feet, and you know, showing an interest in them, in their lives and in their interests, and inspiring them to look beyond the screens and the phones and, you know, the strange tunnel vision of the modern world. You know, passing them literature that's way above their reading level. After only about 2 years in Cottonwood, Pastor Yeager moved on to some other congregation. Maybe, I can't remember. Maybe he took a position teaching in a university or a Bible school somewhere else. I don't know. I don't remember. But I remember being sad to see him go. I remember this. I remember him saying that the only way to really understand the book of Revelation was from an Orthodox Jewish perspective. And that thought stayed with me my entire life and has informed my approach and our approach to eschatology. And that's changed everything because eschatology ultimately drives discipleship. That eschatology, when understood from a Jewish perspective, hinges on the story of the redemption, as told in the story of the Megillah, of the Megillah of Esther, the story of Purim, and the story of redemption as told in the story of the Passover. These holidays, these appointed times. And there's a future day coming when Hashem is going to again intervene to rescue his people from our enemies, to rescue Israel with a great Yeshua, as he did at the Red Sea. There's a climactic ending to this story coming, a final battle that is surely coming. And when it does, Yeshua will emerge as the victor in this fight. And in that final confrontation, the last enemy to be defeated is death itself. And when you know that, when you know that death is not the end, you truly cannot lose. I don't mean that in a suicide death cult sense of a martyr ideology like Mahdi Jihadi Shia Islam. I mean it like this, that no matter what happens, you know that in the end, it's going to be okay. Until then, our job is to remain faithful to our Master's calling and to bear testimony to his resurrection and his coming kingdom. May it come soon in our days and in our lifetimes. Maranatha.